At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we have the unpleasant task, unfortunately, of having to talk about that Raiders game one more time. The offense this time, including some offensive line results that folks are probably not going to like. But here to join me with that and make it a lot better is Jeremy Kahn of 105.7. Jeremy, how you doing?
I'm good, man. It looks like some alphabet soup grades on that offensive line when we get to it. But, yeah, I mean, other than the Ravens being 0-2 and having such a strange week in the NFL, I mean, I'm doing well, but it just sucks to start the season off 0-2 because everybody gets in a panic.
Yeah, it's not a pleasant time in Baltimore, and we've seen the tenor of John Harbaugh's interview is very difficult. It's a time where there's some people who don't seem to mind asking a question that Harbaugh doesn't like. There's other people who they really don't want to do it, and they're walking on eggshells around him. And when I feel like I have to be walking on eggshells around John, I'm much less likely to ask a question. I'm not there during the season; I'm there during camp. So it's not always a pleasant situation to be there.
No, and that's the thing. Like it gets tough in my line of work too. And I know we're in the same kind of field, but like doing a radio show, I'd like to be out there as much as I can. But running, you know, my gambling company and other stuff. I was filling in on radio shows all summer long, doing national shows on the BetQL network, which was a lot of fun, but like it takes you away, and getting out the camp, developing some of those relationships. I think that's sometimes where you'll get a little bit of inside information, or you'll find out who doesn't like you when they listen to you. That's a very easy thing to find out as well.
All right. We had a second straight game here where penalties provided were pivotal to the outcome. And obviously that was one of the stories of the game. The Ravens, in a lot of ways, did enough on offense and defense to win. They out-yarded the Raiders 383 to 260. They out-yarded them per play 6.1 to 4.3. Those are numbers where you typically will win a football game. Particularly the 4.3 yards per play for the Raiders is typically going to get it done. But just a weird kind of a game in terms of the penalties really taking over.
Yeah, because like I feel like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, Ken, like a lot of people would look at penalties and say that falls on the coaching staff of what these guys are getting coached up to do. I don't know that that's necessarily fair, but it's always going to happen that way. And with John Harbaugh-led teams, we haven't seen penalties like this as much. Don't get me wrong. You're going to have games. Hell, I'll never forget that Lions game where the Ravens drew so many different penalties and Terrell Suggs had malice in his heart on Monday Night Football. But, you know, you start to look back at it and you're going, are the refs being unfair to the Ravens, or are they doing some stupid things out there that they can correct? I mean, there are a lot of things that we can look at in this game and even going back to the Chiefs game saying, okay, were they kind of the guinea pig for this new offensive line thing? Were they really offsides? And then going back to this, we have a couple questionable calls. And sometimes it's not even about the calls you make. It's the ones you miss that are so frustrating.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And in this game, the Harbaugh in his Monday press conference really walked it back. And I think he took it as an opportunity to basically take another shot at the officials for some bad calls. But he's like, boy, you can talk about, you know, and then he labeled the four penalties that everybody thought were, you know, personal fouls or the holding on Stanley that were kind of questionable. And then he said, but what are you going to do about the false starts? And the false starts were costly, you know, two very costly false starts from Henry. But that's not why he said that. He said that because he wanted to hit the officials boom, boom, one more time across the face for missing those other calls.
Yeah, and hopefully not getting fined, right? Like trying to find a way around it to take your shot and not get fined. But look, I would agree with him on a lot of things as far as the officiating early on. I know a lot of people talk about the play in the end zone with Davante Adams and whether or not that was pass interference. And, you know, you and I had a chance to talk about it. I'm in that boat. And look, I normally side with wide receivers in this, full disclosure. But I'm in that boat. Like, it all matters how you let these guys play throughout the game, because there's hand fighting going on when the ball's in the air. And, you know, like you go back to even the Super Bowl that they won, the Jimmy Smith play, was that some sort of pass interference or illegal contact? You know, it's always going to be some sort of gray area when you look at things. The only thing that I had an issue with on that penalty is the guy that threw it. I mean, that's coming all the way across the field, and I'm going, can't you guys huddle up and try to get this right? Much like the face mask penalty that wasn't, you know. Those are some of those things that I would look at and say, I don't know how we can't get this right. And you know, we were talking about, I think the eye in the sky buzzes down and tells those guys some things to try to get it sped up, to line up the ball where it's spotted, for example, some of those things. I don't know why they can't handle some of the other stuff when the refs are all getting together just to make sure they get it right. It's either do it for everything or do it for nothing, because then that's where you allow some anomalies to happen when they're reffing games, and maybe you can see it being one-sided outside of maybe a little home cooking.
But Gene Steratore was uncharacteristically vocal about what had happened in the game. He came out heavily that both the face mask penalty was wrong. He said it would have ended up in the same place because they should have had a personal foul on Ajabo for falling on the play. Of course, that's not really the same place. It's 8 yards difference of field position, because that would have been after the play, and it would have been a 15-yard mark off from that spot, not negating the play.
Yeah.
And the other one was the pass interference in the end zone. His explanation was fairly detailed. He said, look, I saw hand fighting going in both directions. I did not see either player gaining an advantage from that fighting. Coming out of that fighting, Stevens made a play on the ball and knocked it down. I thought that I was not in favor of the call, I believe, what he said in that situation.
Yeah, usually I'm pretty opinionated on these things, and that's why I said I'm a little indifferent depending on it, because – look, there is hand fighting, and the defensive player is supposed to have as much right to the ball as the offensive player. Mm-hmm. Usually what we see is when the ball's in the air is that there might be a wide receiver coming back to it. And then if the defender's not looking back for the ball, you could see some of those things happen with some hand fighting and pass interference. But that ball was in the air for a while, and they both were kind of like looking at it. And it's kind of weird to see them side by side looking back at the ball instead of one being behind or in front of the other. So, yeah, that's why, like, if you asked me and you said you have to make a call, I would have made no call. And that's not being Ravens, you know, I'm not trying to be a homer or anything. But again, when it was called, I'm going, I don't have as much of a problem with that as some of the other ones that they missed. And even just to go back a week with Kansas City, I just felt like I got an argument with some people. It's like, they had the same amount of calls. That's fine. But how many did they miss? Was one team way more aggressive than the other with grabbing and holding and being offsides and lining up in the neutral zone, whether it's defense or offense? I think those things apply as well.
Well, that's fair enough. Anyway, I don't want to talk too much about the penalties, because I don't want to make this be a whiny show about penalties. There are plenty of other things that the Ravens had a chance to seal this game away and didn't get it done. But, you know, around the NFL, a weird week in terms of some odd stuff happening. You have your hand more than anybody I know on the gambling pulse of the NFL. What did you see this week that was really outside the lines?
Well, I mean, Vegas just made so much money. It was one of the most ridiculous weeks for underdogs, not only covering, but winning outright. We had a situation coming in, I think, until the Houston Texans Bears game, which was a push at six, but where teams were 8-0 against the spread when they were 6-point underdogs. And you don't typically see that. You know, it looks like there's a little bit more parity. Maybe it's mediocrity, but there were a couple of games in specific that just kind of drew my ire, mainly because I bet on them and lost. But I had the Giants this week against the Commanders, and the Giants kicker gets hurt in the first quarter, which means they tried their punter on an extra point. That meant they were going for it on fourth down. If they score, they're going for two, which, look, that's boom or bust when you don't have the decision to make there, because you're not bringing in your punter if you didn't like the way he was kicking. This is the third time in NFL history that a team has scored three touchdowns and not given up one and lost. I mean, you just have to think about how ridiculous that is. If you don't kick any extra points, I mean, they've got to get six field goals at least to tie you.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's a defensive touchdown or something. I don't know how they factor that in. But just a really weird anomaly that the Giants had no business losing that game. I thought the Ravens thing was pretty interesting when you start looking at it. And we see this more often now, percentage of chance to win. You know, when it gets up there in the 90s and we see something goofy happening. Somebody sent me the Ravens where it was all the way up at the top, and then it went choo, way down at the bottom. And you're like, man, that's crazy how that happened. The other game that I think you could appreciate is that Lions game. The Lions had the ball 2/3 of the time for if you want to talk about, you know, time management and possession. They ran 40 some more plays than the Buccaneers. They were 1-for-7 in the red zone. And then they lose the game outright. From the statistical standpoint, they had no business losing that game whatsoever. When you look at, you know, how many opportunities you had, where you were on the field, big plays, just some goofy things that happened in the game. You also have Dan Campbell, who can be a little weird at times and go for it when you're going, I don't know why he's doing that. But like that game in particular, it should have been a Lions win. I don't know if they end up covering or whatever, but it just, when you see the outcome, it's kind of strange. And then you get around to some of the other games in the league, the Kansas City, Cincinnati game coming down to that pass interference call, which was absolutely pass interference. I don't know why we're getting into this all the time, but if you get there early, that's how it's going to be. And then even Monday Night Football with Atlanta and Philadelphia, where Kirk Cousins looks awful for 3.5 quarters. And he's like, he's terrible in primetime, as everybody talks about. And here he goes leading his team down the field for a game-winning drive. And I mean, like we talk about it being a game of inches. I mean, Saquon Barkley catches that ball, the game's over with, right? And who expects him to drop that pass? So, yeah, a really weird week from a gambling standpoint where the house cleaned up, not only on the money lines, they killed all the teasers, they killed the straight-up bets. Yeah, they can live off of this for the rest of the year, in my opinion.
All right. There's one other thing that we just looked up during our production meeting here, and I was really surprised by this. But starts with the odds to win the AFC North right now. Believe it or not, at 0-2, the Ravens are the favorite to win the AFC North. And it's marginal, with Cincinnati being the other team who is almost equally favored. So the Ravens are 2.1-1, Cincinnati 2.15-1, Pittsburgh with their 2-0 record, 3.5-1, and Cleveland with their 1-1 record and nobody believing in Deshaun Watson is 5.5-1 right now to win the North. Okay.
So, yeah, I was just going to say, when you said that earlier, I went, that sounds weird. But when you're talking about winning the AFC North, the Ravens still have 6 games left against their opponents. Mm-hmm. The thing that I would say is a little concerning is that the Steelers have 2 road wins. They come back for their home opener in week 3. They get the Chargers on back-to-back road games on the East Coast. I didn't see yet if the Chargers decided to stay on the East Coast after beating the crap out of Carolina. But, yeah, like it, I get it from that standpoint, but the Ravens really have to hold serve against their home opponents and start to pick up some wins on the road as well. And then with this week being at Dallas, I mean, it's a pick 'em game. So anything can happen in my mind in a game like that.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I don't think it's time to hit the panic button for a lot of reasons for the Ravens, because I think, A, they're healthy. You know, and all of the other Ravens teams, which have had really bad starts, dug themselves a big hole. It's basically been health has been a major concern. Even if you go back as far as 1999, the Ravens really cost themselves a playoff spot by losing the first 2 games of that season. I think it was the Rams, and then it might have been the Steelers at home, but it was the Rams 27-10 on the road who went on to win the Super Bowl. And then I believe it was the Steelers at home. Scott Mitchell was a quarterback. They had to find their solution in the second half of that year, which was Tony Banks was their solution at quarterback. So it's really, you know, there have been previous times when they've got themselves in a hole when it's felt a hell of a lot more desperate than this current situation is. And you know, this team has one major weakness. It's the offensive line. There's still a chance that could work out. And the big problem obviously is they face this tough schedule early. When the offensive line, they may not have a chance to gel or, and frankly, to get the right players in there.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because you start looking at, and I'm interested to hear your grades, obviously, for it, because people were talking, hey, did you see Pro Football Focus's grades on the offensive line? It wasn't as bad as you thought. I mean, I just kept seeing Falele as a turnstile, and it's just tough. It's tough when you're watching that. So you look at this team, too. The Raiders game was the one that you kind of had circled as a must win. Even though it's technically not, but you expect to win that game.
Yep.
That's the tough part. And now you got to go on the road to a Dallas team that just got embarrassed on national TV. And then, of course, you're picking yourself up against the Bills on Sunday Night Football. So, I mean, they've put themselves behind the eight ball, but I still think they're good enough to pull out a couple. Even if they get out of the next 5 stretch at 2-3, they're fine. They're perfectly right. Fine.
I'd probably sign up for that right now, honestly, given who they play the next 3 weeks. It'd be a tough call. I definitely sign up for it if one of the wins is Cincinnati.
Yeah. I
mean, you do that in a heartbeat, but yeah, no, I definitely said, what am I talking about? They don't have a 67% chance to win each of the next 3 games. They're much lower than that. So I definitely take 2-3.
Yeah.
Anyway, almost no aggregate juice on that line, which is that's often the case, by the way, when you have a division where there's a lot of division among the various books that you look at. And so I take the best price from about 20 online books. It's actually, the Odds Checker now lists fewer. It's more like 5 or 6 online books they list for this. But you can, whoever you're betting, or if you bet your money equally on each of the teams, you can guarantee yourself a 1.6% loss of your total money. That's there. And if that number is under 1, by the way, if the aggregate odds with the VIG is you know 0.995, and you see that sometimes, there's actually a guaranteed win you can create yourself by dividing out your money in a certain way. And the problem also is that, of course, and you know this, I know, but mm-hmm. you don't get paid off till January, so there's significant time value of money lost on that. So you still wouldn't do it. But
it's a big hold, right? So they've got the hold there where the money's tied up for a long period of time. The other part of it is every once in a while you'll find that nugget where the books may have made a mistake, or if you're using multiple books, you can kind of make it work in your favor. But they're so good. They're so sharp at keeping this stuff relatively right. And with the NFL, there's so much time. The way you want to take advantage of some of those things is more in college football and college basketball. I would say basketball more importantly, because there's something every day and there's just so many teams to keep track of.
All right. All right. Let's keep moving on with the offense here. So the special teams play, I do want to talk about that. I didn't really hit it up as hard as I should have on the defensive episode, though Jordan Cohen and I talked a little bit about that. I would like for you folks to go back and listen to that if you would. But it had a shanked punt leading to the game-winning field goal. On that play, they also had that penalty by Holman for running out of bounds, which was 5 extra yards, just a little extra knife twist in the side to get him closer. But they would have had to actually run some plays to get in field goal range. You had the Tucker miss from 56 yards. Now, there's a lot of Tucker apologists right now, and I'm in that camp, who basically say he's still the best kicker in the NFL. His misses are coming from very long, and all that is true, but we still depend on Justin Tucker making some of these kicks over 50, and he's 1 for 7 now the last 2 years. So one question I have is, all of his reduction in quality of play has been these last 3 years with Jordan Stout as a holder, and I wonder if it's not still true that Sam, the drop-off from Sam Cook to Stout is impacting Tucker, or if I have to be more reasonable and say, well, he's also age 33 to 35 for Tucker, and we should expect some decline from him physically where he's not going to be the same kicker he used to be.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to it, because I think most people would overlook the minutia of that, talking about a holder. But, mm-hmm. I mean, you get comfortable with certain guys. There's a certain way you want the ball put down, and timing. I think the timing has to be impeccable for you to get what you want. The lift on the football, avoiding the big guys up front, the trajectory to where it's not low enough for them to block it. And sometimes on those deep field goals, it is going to be a little lower coming out to get that lift. Yep. But I don't, like, I've been defending Justin Tucker too, because as much as everybody was screaming about it, I bet they were screaming, they hope he gets a chance to kick one, even if it was from 70, because I still think the same way you do. I still think he's the best kicker in the league. There are other guys that are on par, whether you like them or not, like Harrison Butker. Everybody talks about the kid in Dallas. I mean, even McPherson with the Bengals has kind of come on. They were calling him a younger version of Justin Tucker. He's been the best at his position and arguably the best kicker in the history of the league for a long period of time. And you forget how long he's been here. I did talk to someone that said they were a little bit concerned. They felt like on the deeper kicks, he does a little bit more of a crow hop before he kicks it, which would suggest that he needs to get a little bit more on that. I don't know if that's factual. I want to watch more games and see it for myself. But, you know, like the fact that he's missed all these 50-yarders, and people aren't looking at 56, 58, 50. Of course you're going to miss some. What's the weather? Is it indoors? Is it outdoors? You know, like those things all factor into me, where I think it's a little bit unfair how Justin Tucker's treated. And I even said this to you, like, we've been kind of spoiled with the kickers we've had here for a long time.
We certainly have, in terms of Tucker and Stover and the dark years in between we shall not speak of, the Cundiff and whatnot. Oh, boy, we just spoke about it up here. The reason that I think this might be the time to bring up Sam Cook's name is that I actually have no idea whether he still lives in the Baltimore area or not. I know he came in here to coach Stout on some holding things, but the Ravens so far with their kickoff strategy have netted minus 11 yards net so far this year. I'm sorry, minus 3 yards. That number is wrong there. It's minus 3 yards for the year so far versus touchback on every play. Okay. Now there was a board penalty in there that admittedly is a large portion of that. They also got a holding call. So I'm not going to, you can't just throw out penalties on either side, but they haven't been good at covering kicks. And I think more importantly, there's a lot of injury risk entailed with trying to cover kicks. So I don't think it's really worth it. I don't think they're getting paid for that risk. I don't think they're getting paid at all for the risk of field position other than the 30, obviously, certainly since they're in negative territory. So the question to me is, how about cutting a guy who's primarily used on special teams? You don't have to cut him even. How about just deactivating a guy? Because you can activate Cook from the practice squad. Deactivating a guy who's on the 53, is it might be Kane or Braid at the end of your team and on special teams who basically has to sit. And then you have Sam Cook as a holder. Stout focuses on punting only. And I think the number of points you could pick up over a whole season is actually pretty significant from this. It might be 5, 6, 7 points of expected kickoff and extra point and field goal value that you'd find very valuable. And it's, by the way, very hard to make any other change on the field that would give you that kind of point break.
Yeah, and the other thing with this too is it's not only about getting someone in there that's a better holder or even perfect at it, if you will, because we've heard about that Wolfpack and how good they've been, even with Sam Cook leaving. It's also giving him a chance to just focus on what he needs to do. Because I'm kind of curious that when you brought it up, I started thinking, what's the norm around the league? Is it a backup quarterback? We've seen starting quarterbacks be holders. I remember when Tony Romo dropped the snap and almost ran it in for a 2-point conversion. Or if it is a lot of punters or someone else that's there. But there has to be a kind of – you have to build a rapport with those guys, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. My dog's going ape in the background here. But
he's mad at the calls too.
Yeah, no, she's a good girl. All right. So anyway, I know we talked about this on the morning show on 105.7, but the Ravens will never do it, okay? And yet it's something they should really consider – given how little they're getting out of kickoff coverage. And you go into a game with usually about 14 guys, and you've got more than that, but who could do it if you needed them to. But you've got about 14 guys who probably are available to play special teams, and they are mix and match for your punt and kickoff unit. So they're each taking some of those snaps. They have a role. You stand up 1 to 11 the night before to make sure you know who you are on those units. But then people get hurt, and you have to replace them. So you need some backups in that area. You reduce your need to backups on the kickoff to zero if you're always kicking a touchback. I mean, it's the nature of the game. And the other thing, I don't want to go too far on this, is how bad would it be to have Brent Urban on the current kickoff rule covering kicks? And I'll just throw his name out because he was inactive on the first week. And I'd say it's a two-gapping job now. You stand 10 yards apart. You don't have to run the length of the field. You don't have to maintain lane integrity for a whole long time. But you have a player who's a good tackler who can stand somebody up with amazing leverage opposite him and break to either side to make that tackle. I think you're probably going to be able to build a kickoff or coverage unit around that.
Yeah, I mean, there's plenty of guys you could hide there if you wanted to bolster your roster and elsewhere, because usually you're talking about some of those special team spots you'd like open. If you're going to kick it out of the end zone, this is one of the things I've been thinking about, because I always like to see the coaches I respect to see how they're working the kickoff. Like Belichick, when it was changed, he started hitting boomers all the way down in front of the goal line, and where you were forced to bring it, or forced to take off, and they felt like their coverage team could get down there quickly. I was listening to them talk about squib kicking, which that's kind of out. As you start to look at some of the other things with kickoffs, I mean, I'm trying to find out if there's any type of value in either kicking it through the end zone and doing that every time, or if there's a way around this to where you could have success on those kickoffs by kicking it shorter. Because, again, it sounds like the squib kick is out, that you're not going to be able to do that anymore with the way that the rules are enforced. But I'm interested to look around the league and try to watch this more to see what teams – are trying to do on the kickoff, if there's any advantage to be had.
Yeah, and it may be that we just see more touchbacks as time goes on. I think the new kickoff rule really favors the receiving team relative to what was there before, because I don't think the average field position was anywhere close to the 30, and that's what I think we're seeing right now. All right, let's get back to the offense because that's what we're supposed to be talking about. The Ravens won the snap battle 63-60. They had a big drop in series success rate this week. They still weren't bad, but they had a big drop from the first week. I guess some of the general things about this game is we really did see Derrick Henry have a very tough first half, come back in quarter three, really dominate the game, give the Ravens a pretty substantial lead. But then he had two costly false starts in Q4 that in part were a contributing factor to the loss.
It sounds kind of weird when you think about your running back having a false start and then having a second one. Makes me think he was definitely getting the ball and he just amped up to go get it. But like, I don't get that. I don't understand. I know sometimes these guys are leaning forward. I used to tell my kids in coaching basketball, when they're inbounding the ball, stop leaning. You're not going anywhere. You're just going to throw the ball to someone because you get them leaning, and then all of a sudden they're ready to step over the line. But the false start stuff was just kind of strange. And for all the good that he did, as you were talking about second, third quarter into the fourth, I'm not saying it's totally wiped away. It was nice to see Derrick Henry look like Derrick Henry, but that sucked, man, because especially on third and one, when you change up everything you can do, and it's not the sole reason they lost the game, but it definitely had an impact on it.
Yeah, it would have had the ball again with likely would have been able to get that first down. They would have been able to defend the 7-point lead for longer that they had at that point. So it hurt. It really hurt. Anyway, what I want to get to, I lost my spot here. Yeah. What I thought was good about the Ravens, and I think it's time for a lot of Ravens fans to, I don't know. You can't tell fans to shut up because that's their fans. They want to talk about football and it, but there's a large portion of people who think Derrick Henry's not getting the ball enough. I thought in this game, they really stuck with him as much as they possibly could in terms of game script. In fact, they had 11 yards at halftime. And there was only this one component of the one game I want to get to a little later that I don't think the Ravens were committed to, but by and large, they were committed to Derrick Henry, and they tried to get him the football. They tried to get him to the outside, away from the big linemen of Oakland, sorry, of Las Vegas, who were definitely the strength of the team. But it just didn't work out. And then when they did get the ball back in Q4, they had to try some other things to advance the football.
Yeah, and you know, as you were talking about that too, I kind of felt like I wanted to see more of Derrick Henry in week one, just because it's your new toy and you're going up against the defending champs, and I thought we'd see a heavy dose of him. But I kind of hope this is how they use him the whole year. And then, like, Tennessee's done this before too, where you get to the month of December, as I jokingly call Dehember, as that's what they called it in Tennessee, where he just kind of gets going, leading you into the playoffs. But it is something where, watching this guy, you want to see him get his 15 touches. I was kind of happy to see him catch a pass, because at first I was looking at it going, who is that? And then I saw the 22. I was like, okay, get him out in space. I know he doesn't have the best hands, but anytime you can get somebody like that out in space, I think it's dangerous.
Yeah, he's been fairly effective as a receiver. It definitely could be part of the game in that way. They definitely are getting him the football when he's on the field. We'll get to that in a little bit. We got a detailed offensive line scoring. They'll come up in the second part of the show. The good news is quite limited in terms of what occurred in the game, unfortunately. The Ravens, I thought, on third and fourth down, that was not the strong part of the team in this game. They went 4 of 11 on third and fourth down. That's not good enough against a team like the Raiders. They really need to. The difference often is one, and it's always a small sample size. So you're really talking about small things. But one extra conversion in this game might have been the difference, particularly if it was late.
Yeah, really controlling the ball. Any one of those that could have. When you think about a game that comes down the way this one did, and I know we can get into timeouts, clock management, and all that stuff, but it's one play or two that can really, not the sole reason you win or lose, but can really help the outcome one way or the other. And this is something I get into all the time in talking to people. Like, it's not one person's fault that they lose the game. There are multiple things that go on. Maybe he gets a bigger slice of the pie, if you want to look at it that way. But there are plenty of things you can look at a game, especially a game like this where you lose on a field goal and you have an opportunity at the end to get down the field and it doesn't work out. I mean, if Isaiah Likely catches that ball, it was a great play by the defender. Maybe we're talking a little bit differently today, because it's so weird. You can have so many things go wrong in a football game, but if you come out with the W, nobody talks about it. It's like it's forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely true. And you're much more likely, as the fans of the losing team, to talk about the 25 things that cost you the game, Whereas if you're a fan of the winning team, you won by three. Yeah, they had it all the way. Kind of. there's always a number of plays. The Ravens were fine in the red zone. They're fine in goal to go. Two out of three in the red zone. That's okay. And two out of two in goal to go. You can't do better. So it really wasn't a case of any kind of other specific situational football that got them in a hole. It was just a case of better. Third and fourth down were not good enough. But other than that, it was a bunch of costly penalties that were really things. So if you're just diagnosing this corpse, it's really about the penalties. It's not about about much of anything else. The Ravens did defensively and offensively pretty much what they needed to win the game.
Ken, I know we might get into this a little bit later. Is there something to be said about showing your hand depending on which back is in the game, whether you're running it or throwing it? I think that's something, not to say they've become totally predictable, but it is something you can look at. And you can guess right. Like, if you're going to have Justice Hill out there and he's only going to carry the ball once and they throw it on all the other plays, I got a pretty good chance of guessing right that you're throwing the football when he's out there.
Yeah, they've definitely relied on Justice Hill as a blocking back in particular. And so it's a good chance you've got a pass play. Of course, he's also typically out there on passing downs. He's going to be out there on second and 10, on third and eight, third and six kind of thing. So some of it, you're not really giving away anything more because he's out there. If you're using Hill on a first down play, I don't know that necessarily means anything, but Hill certainly is a low touch per snap player. And Henry is a very high touch per snap player. And so you really see that. I think the goal is to keep Henry rested. They are missing some value from getting Henry out there as a pass blocker. In this game, we'll get to this a little later, but Hill was out there 10 times as a set blocker, and the Ravens really overcommitted in terms of trying to stop what was primarily a four-man pass rush with a lot of eligible receiver blocking. And that was one of the big holes for the Ravens offense. As much as they generally performed okay, they gave up explosiveness in the passing game because they committed so much of their eligible receiver group to pass blocking. I want to talk about that a little later because I think it's an important thing to get to. Let's move on to Lamar Jackson though and talk about him. I always like to get that done in the first show, but did not take over the game with his legs this week. First of all, do you think that's a good idea? Keep him healthy for the whole year, or how did you feel about it?
Yeah, look, I'm fine with it because eventually he's got to evolve to that point. Because, I mean, there's some things to be said. There are different quarterbacks that when it comes to the postseason, they start to run a little bit more. Pat Mahomes, Aaron Rodgers used to be one of those guys. Like, hey, I'm going to do everything I can to win. Absolutely. And then you have other guys like Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson. I'd even put Kyler Murray in there to a degree that are going to run all year long. To what degree, though? Because he is the best ball carrier that we've seen. I mean, I know Devontae Adams said it. He does so many special things that you want to keep him around for the long haul. Now, I actually like when he runs on pass plays when they break down more than the design runs. That's me. I don't know how other people feel about it because
completely agree.
Yeah, because then things are breaking down and he's so special in that moment. He's so good at making something happen when there's nothing there. Some of the problems that I still think he's having, like I'd love to see him hit receivers in stride a little bit more. We have a lot of there were a lot of Mark Andrews catches and falls down or diving for the ball. Some tough plays to make. You expect your receivers to make some of those plays, but I think we have a lot of good yak guys on this team that aren't getting the opportunity to showcase that.
Yeah, it's probably true. I mean, Lamar left a very big play on the field in this game on the throw to Andrews. Early second quarter, I think it was. I had it in here, I thought. Yeah, Q2, 14-21. It looked like it might go for 40-plus yards. It was a deep route that Andrews seemed to be going for one corner. But anyway, the ball was overthrown by about 5 yards. And it was under pressure, but it's a throw that Lamar, I know, wishes he had back and could have completed because it's one of those that would have gone for a long thing. Andrews was probably open by about 4 yards on the play. So definitely one where there was an opportunity there for some significant yak. The other thing that I'd point to. Well, okay, let's go back to the rushing game for a second because Lamar only rushed the ball 5 times. One of those times was on the last play of the game where he had the lateral, but he had a lot of free yards before he got started. As soon as I saw him get like basically 20 yards without even blinking, it was already a good play design relative to other Hail Mary type plays that occur at that time. It was just too far for the end zone. And it's a case where, you know, hey, maybe you get a series of laterals going, and then unfortunately Justice Hill throws the ball forward.
Yeah, and Zay Flowers, look, it's such a low percentage chance of making that happen. Whether you throw the Hail Mary, first off, can you get it to the end zone from that standpoint?
Right.
I think it happened in the Colts game with their quarterback, Anthony Richardson, who they said had one of the strongest arms in the league, and he had to throw a 70-yard pass to get in the end zone. And under duress and everything going on, he was still about 8 yards short. So maybe you get a penalty. Maybe you get something that helps you out. That's why I like throwing it. But I do take umbrage to some of the people saying he should have just run it into the end zone. There was a lane. You don't get to freeze frame it and go, hey, there's a lane there. Those guys don't stay there once Lamar starts running again. It's, you know, it's difficult because it closes. And I'm sure made the decision to throw it back because he felt like he wasn't going to get there. But yeah, I mean, look, when you get into those situations, you have such a small percentage chance to win. I'm not saying it's impossible, but the mathematics say that it's not likely it's going to happen.
Yeah. That was a lot of his yards. He was outrushed by Henry 18-5 in the game. I think that's what people kind of expect for this season, is they expect more leaning on Derrick Henry. That's why you got him. And I think I'm all for that.
Didn't you know it's possible to get THC shipped right to your door? Mood delivers premium 100% federally legal THC directly to you. I'm talking about delicious high potency gummies, top shelf flower, home baked cookies, vapes, anything you'd find at a dispensary. You can now order online and have it shipped quickly, discreetly, and conveniently right to your door. And every Mood product is made from pesticide free cannabis grown on America's best small farms at prices that won't destroy your wallet. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with code RAVENS. So head to mood.com/ravens, check out their online dispensary, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code RAVENS when you check out to save 20% on your first order.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
And like you, I'm a big fan of the scrambles. There's only one of those in this game. He scrambled once for 8 yards and took 2 sacks for whatever it was. I think it's 15. So 3 for -7 in the game was his FNTP, or forced not to pass number. That's not what you'd hope to get from Lamar Jackson. You'd hope to get more scramble yards than sack yards, for starters. And in the first game, he was just unbelievable. He had 9 scrambles and 1 sack for a net of 64 yards. That's off the charts great. This was the other direction. This was not good. This is what you might see from a very immobile quarterback, a Peyton Manning late career or something like that, that he would not give you much to offset the sacks.
So what do you make of, again, we're talking about being a little bit predictable with the run game and some of the things you're doing. And I know Harbaugh mentioned it this week about you got to get some play action pass. You got two of the best runners in the league. You have to start setting some things up and faking the ball to them to push it downfield. Because, like, I don't know how many linebackers or even safeties, when they see Derrick Henry in the backfield, they don't want to get him in open space by themselves on the back end. They want to be coming forward to where they can kind of get low and don't give him much room to move around. We finally got to see that Derrick Henry stiff arm, which was great. But, like, again, I want to see more of that play action pass to see what Lamar can do off of it, because it's such a dangerous weapon in this game.
Yeah, completely agree, by the way. And I thought, even against Kansas City, which has a lot of weapons, a lot of bunch formation they run off of, they got Rashee Rice, they got Worthy. I thought the most dangerous weapon in each of these games has been the Lamar Henry mesh point, that you don't even have to go all the way into it. And the Ravens typically have not any kind of forward facing look, any kind of ability to display that the mesh might occur, is going to give you an opportunity to hit play action shots to your tight ends, who were a lot of the Ravens receiving talent. And so I really don't agree with not using play action. I think they will be forced. Monken and Harbaugh probably have a discussion this week, forcing more play action into the game. And I think I actually heard that from Harbaugh's interview yesterday. Don't care, because Harbaugh would tell us whatever. Yeah. but I do believe it makes all kinds of sense that Harbaugh will force more of that into the gameplay.
Yeah, and it'd be nice to see, because again, I just think that makes you a little bit more dangerous. If you've got guys coming forward, throwing it over their head, especially, I mean, they have speed, they have athleticism at their wide receiver position. For so long, this team has been devoid of actually having legitimate talent there. I mean, Torrey Smith was one of those guys, or even getting, you know, some of the receivers at the back end of their careers. We had always talked about the Ravens having issues drafting that position. And now, like, I know people are down on Bateman to a degree, but I think both of these guys can get separation, he and Zay. And I'm fine with the way they've been using Zay, but I think he can do so much more than what they've had him doing.
Right. Yeah. I'm a big fan of getting Zay separation, using him on more deep routes. You know, the more space you create between level two and three, the more Zay is able to operate in those levels and find space for you. That's really useful as well. But when you, if you're constantly using Zay as a gadget player, you do restrict his value. So, yeah, let's go back to talk about Lamar a little bit. Let's start with numbers that the Raiders rushed here, because they rushed 5+ on 6 occasions. That did include one drive ending play. They allowed 5.5 yards per pass when they rushed 6+, but it's only 6 times in the whole game of what is 34 passes, because 2 passes are spikes and are excluded from this discussion. They rushed 4 28 other times. They didn't rush 3 at all. They rushed 4 28 times. So basically, the Ravens faced a 4-man pass rush, oftentimes a 4-man pass rush with a spy, that they had, you know, somebody standing behind the line of scrimmage on the defensive side waiting for Lamar Jackson to exit the pocket, which is some of the reason why we probably saw less scrambles in this game. It was just that they were effective in using a spy. I do think it's still a little disappointing that Lamar couldn't get it going with some scrambles, even with 5 there, because he's still got 5 offensive linemen, 6 gaps with 5 to fill, that could give him some opportunity there.
Yeah, you know, and look at some of the other things that you were pointing out there with Lamar and having some opportunities, because the Raiders might be one of the few teams that can feel comfortable rushing 4 and getting away with it on the back end, depending on scheme and everything. But I always, like, I found it interesting a few years ago when the cover 0 was working a lot with Lamar and how teams went to that. But again, getting after him, because he's so special in the backfield that he does create plays. Even some of the touchdown throws that we've seen him have over the past, I'll go back to the last game with the Chiefs, the one that wasn't between Bateman and Flowers. But, like, he makes things happen when he's under duress. Not that I want him under duress all the time. I just think he's one of those guys that's so special in those moments that I enjoy as a football fan watching it, maybe not so much as a Ravens fan.
Yeah, I don't like the Lamar injury risk. I love Lamar at using his legs and mm-hmm. what it does to opposing defenses. And just even against the Chiefs in week 1, he was demoralizing and gassing that defense in that second half in a way that really gave the Ravens a chance to come back in that football game. But it didn't end up working out.
When you're breaking down film and you look at it, are you surprised that sometimes the defense that teams are presenting to the Ravens, like the different, or do we see a lot of the same elements? Because, like, it's a copycat league, and if somebody has success, I'm sure they're going to try to steal it. You got to have the personnel. Like, if you go back to the Ravens' first playoff game with Lamar, not everybody had the Chargers' personnel to be able to do what they did in that playoff game. But at the same extent, you know, we did have the copycat with cover 0, and then now I'm wondering if we see some other things if teams start to look at it. I just wonder if you're surprised ever watching what teams try to do to Lamar.
I'm probably surprised on a week-to-week basis with some of the things that occur. I wouldn't say, you know, I'm so prescient that I figured out what everything was in advance, certainly. But but I think there are things we see from certain teams that are a little bit predictable. So the Chiefs, being a smaller team up front, did a lot of run blitzing and committing to the run with their linebackers in ways that other teams watch, which you basically, you hand the game to your secondary at that point, trying to, with a lot of man coverage responsibilities effectively. I think, you know, we saw that in week 1 a fair amount. I think that the Raiders were reasonably effective at what they did in terms of their 4-man rush for starters, which they were solid with, but they got a good amount of pressure, but also in just having a spy and being able to keep the barn kind of locked on Lamar getting out. That was particularly effective. So, you know, am I really surprised week to week? I mean, the teams have different things to look at. It's a, I agree. I think the point I'm hearing you make is that other teams can copy things that they do successfully. What was successful about the Raiders in the way they rushed was that they forced the Ravens to make an additional commitment of eligible receivers to block. And that ended up really hurting the Ravens passing game, I think.
It's interesting. See, and again, that's why, like, I ask these questions because, you know, you look at Lamar and you're like, I don't know that a team's going to try to run man against him. You got to have a spy, and that spy better be pretty good. Because, like, again, when we talk about how things break down, it's one of the things about Mike Vick that you send all these guys out on routes and he's like, hey, is everybody's back to me right now? I'm taking off, you know? So, but it is a lot of fun to watch him work back there. But again, I want to see him get a little bit more polished in the passing game. The running and all that's, I think it's always going to be there until it's not. As you get older and you start to slow it down, but the more polish he gets in the passing game, I just feel like it makes him arguably the most dangerous player in the league.
Yeah, I would agree. I think he's still the most dangerous player in the league. Absolutely. So if we go down to the next thing I want to talk about is ample time and space, ball out quick and pressure. Now, I don't explain this every week or anything, but I divide the opportunities into three sets. Ample time and space is effectively a 3-second pocket where the quarterback has room to step into his throw. There is more to the definition than that, but that's effectively how I define it. Ball out quick means that the ball was out before pressure could develop, but it might have within 3 seconds. Didn't necessarily, but it might have. And then pressure events are all the others where the quarterback is under duress in some way. They had the Raiders did a better job than the Ravens did of getting pressure in this game. Even though the Ravens had 5 sacks, they had 15 ample time and space opportunities and 15 pressures. So the Ravens really converted a high percentage of their pressures. In this case, the Raiders had 13 pressures, but 10 ATS, which is a better relationship, more normal in terms of what you might see. And Lamar was above his expected yards. And by the way, I know I was on the radio this morning and I talked about that. I said he was about on par. I forgot there were 2 spikes in the game and I misallocated the thing. But anyway.
Yeah, we talked about it when you were done, man. We couldn't say he forgot about those spikes.
This idiot. He doesn't know what he's talking about. It's a good thing we didn't call him about that on it.
Oh, man. But no, you always present this great. Like, look, again, I know you're I know I'm the same way. Like, you're highly critical for different things. Like, for me, it's handicapping games and looking at things and you watching film and putting numbers down and making sure everything matches up. Cause I can even tell when you start to give me percentages, and you're like, wait a minute, it wasn't 18. It was 16. And then it's like, okay, I don't think I would have known any different had you not said anything, but.
We don't need to go any further into that, but anyway, it's something with that, that I try and be precise on anyway, but, let's see. Want to talk about that. Lamar ran the team out of just one pressure in this game. Okay. And that was kind of a big deal. Difference from the first game. In week one, ran the offensive line out of 7 pressures, which, by the way, affected offensive line scores in a not insignificant manner. And in this game, it was only one time that he ran him out, and that was that 8-yard run. As a matter of fact, that was one of the ugliest plays you'll ever see. And I don't have a time reference on it, but it's been out there online today. So you may have seen it on Twitter. Is Falele and McCary both whiffed terribly, beaten on the outside, came into the pocket. Lamar had to run. Linderbaum had actually made a mistake, and he thought it was a run play initially, and he blocked his way down, moved 5 yards down the field into level 2, and then he actually said, oh, crap, and he came back to the line of scrimmage because he realized it was originally called as a pass play, not a run play. And if Lamar had actually thrown a pass, it would have been flagged for illegal downfield, and Linderbaum would have actually been the villain of the play and not Falele and McCary who caused the problem. But then Lamar bailed them all out with an 8-yard run, so Linderbaum's not illegally downfield, and the two guys who allowed the pressure effectively were run out of it. So anyway, a pretty awful series, a pretty awful play right there for the Ravens offensive line.
See, but that's what I love about this and getting a chance to talk to you on certain things in the game. Because as I mentioned earlier, when you win the game, it's like a lot of the things that went wrong, people tend to forget about. But for me, like winning a game and being able to correct some of the mistakes you made, it makes it so much. Everybody says you can learn from a loss. Well, hell, I can learn from a win, too. I mean, I can go back and watch the film and see what went wrong. And that's one of the things that, like, it's just cleaning up some of that stuff can take you from a good team to a great team.
And yeah, I hope the Ravens have been pretty good at that over the years. I think they're hopefully self-scout and are fairly critical over what they've done. But anyway, it is what it is. Next Gen showed Lamar with a 2.92 time to throw in this game, just middle of the pack. So it's not like he had he was taking a number of exceptionally long plays, which usually impact that. He did have some quick throws in this game, and he didn't have a bunch of offsetting 5 and 6 second plays, which he sometimes does when he generates a really high number. But I did notice Deshaun Watson had an immense amount of time to throw, like three. It might have been 3.4 seconds, might have been 3.47 even this week, but it was a very high number, which obviously must have been a big relief to the Browns in terms of getting him some extended play value.
Do you think does that necessarily come in from the offensive play? Like, I didn't look at what the defense did there, if they weren't rushing a lot and just dropping guys back.
It is one of the ultimate statistics where there is a countercurrents of causality going on. So you've got, you know, pocket quarterbacks, they basically don't want additional time to throw. Time to throw means they couldn't find people on their successive reads, and it's usually very bad news. Lamar Jackson, a high time to throw number usually translates to good results for him because he is very good at extending plays and making magic happen late. And I think Deshaun Watson probably falls more into the Lamar category than he does into the, you know, late career Peyton Manning or Tom Brady, that you want to get rid of the football quickly. You want to be able to execute multiple fakes and then go.
It makes me wonder where Deshaun Watson is at this point of his career, because, God, man, I was talking about him and I went, 6 years ago, I think I could have made a case that he's one of, if not the best quarterback in the league with his running and throwing ability. Week one, he looked horrendous. Week two, it was better. But for the Browns' sake, I hope it gets better, because that's a lot of money that cat's owed.
And hey, the Browns are a divisional opponent. We want the very worst for them. I love this. In no uncertain terms, that $92 million, I hope they pay it. There was word today, by the way, regarding that contract, that when it was reworked to effectively do, I think, a simple restructure, a restructure of some sort that pushed money further out, that the language was removed that would allow the Browns to negate the contract. Now, if there's a suspension, apparently they can still go after him. But if there's not a suspension, there won't be an opportunity for the Browns to get out of this contract, is how I understood the news story to go. Now, who knows, really?
I'm glad you're saying it, because, like, I saw this yesterday, and I brought it up on the show when we were doing the show. But I said, now with Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, the blue check mark doesn't mean much anymore. So you're looking, I said, I hope this is a reliable source, but guy covers the Browns. So it looked right that they did, I don't want to say waived it, but they changed up the verbiage in the contract to where that's not a possibility. So I still think they're going to have to pay him all that money. I don't know if we get another issue here or something that comes up, but that's for a later date, I guess.
Yeah. Mike Florio is really, he might be a lawyer. He might've been a lawyer. He is. Okay. Yeah. He's definitely playing lawyer in terms of what's going on. And he's done a lot of, pods this week.
So can I give you a little sidebar on him? So one of the funniest things, when I first got in the radio and I became a producer of a morning show, they were like, hey, you got to start booking guests. And I had never done that before, outside of calling John Clayton at 4 a.m. West Coast time and waking him up. He said some interesting things to me. The one thing that I had was, I just started looking up different football, baseball, and basketball websites. And there was a website called Pro Football Talk, Pro Baseball Talk, Pro Basketball Talk. And Mike Florio was a lawyer in West Virginia. He's a Steeler fan, which, for people that say, hey, they take a lot of shot at the Ravens, yeah, I mean, you could probably see why. He's been a lawyer his whole life, and then kind of got into the football stuff. And look, it's worked out for him. But he was one of the first guests that I ever booked. And it's kind of weird to see him blowing up now and seeing him on TV all the time.
Very cool. Do you know what kind of a law he practiced? Was it disability, personal injury, what it was?
Because, you know what, I think it might be that. I think it was like personal injury. So okay. I'd have to go back and look at it. But as soon as you said it, I said that's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah. Cleet Blakeman, who's the official who came to talk about the new kickoff rule to the media this year, said he was a personal injury lawyer in Omaha. And it's just interesting. People come from different fields and they end up in the NFL for various reasons. Anyway, I respect Florio's analysis of the contract, but he refers continuously to a infamous paragraph 42, which talks about an undisclosed list of assailed females or potential claimants who Watson apparently, as part of the original contract, had to fully disclose all of the people who might sue him.
Oh, wow.
And so that's the part that is that nobody, the Browns have that list, and I don't know who else has that list, obviously, but they, if there's another person who comes forward that's not on that list, supposedly, he's not protected. But the problem is that if Watson and that woman get together, which is exactly okay. That's really bad terminology there. But if that woman's lawyer and Watson get together, there's going to be a very high impetus for Watson to settle the suit. Now he's got to be careful because he doesn't want every 10 other women who he's never met before to come forward and claim this. But it's going to be very high. The woman will not want to tell the NFL until she's exhausted all possibility of settling this with Watson, because that's where the money is. Okay. If she cooperates with the NFL, she's either a Joan of Arc like renegade who wants to burn Watson permanently for all the things he's done, which that could be. This could be somebody who's financially secure already. But if we're talking about $5 to $10 million, which is what Watson would probably have to cough up to settle this suit and protect his $92 million that he's still got coming. What that'll in the end mean is that the league really can't proceed. And this is according to Florio, with any kind of an investigation, and won't go anywhere because the woman will just say, "I have nothing to say on the matter," kind of thing. Once she's NDA'd within the settlement.
Yeah. Again, I know we're getting off topic here, but like it's an interesting sidebar to this season. It's one of the strangest things we've seen in sports because we kind of had a couple. I won't say laughs about it because it's still a serious situation where the Browns are like, 23 women? We're cool with that. Wait a minute, there's a 24th? No, we got to get rid of them now. But there were rumors that they thought the Browns leaked out all the contract stuff and some of the other things because there were people that were privy to information that supposedly only Deshaun Watson and the Browns had.
Well, that it would not be nonsensical for them to do so. Obviously, the Browns are the most two-faced situation right now. They literally out of one side of their mouth, they're telling Watson, you're our quarterback, go win us the Super Bowl. And the other side, they're saying, please, anybody who can come forward and get this idiot out of town and get us out of this contract, we'd be happy with. And and they can't say that publicly because of how that looks to their fans and how that looks to their thing. But every Cleveland fan right now would be happy if they were able to get it out of the contract, obviously.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you can get out from under that thing, it opens up every – like I've said this before, I think the Browns have one of the best rosters in the league outside of quarterback. Now, it'll be nice to see him – well, for their sake, I know not for the Ravens, get Nick Chubb back, see what he looks like. But, I mean, you got bookend pass rushers. You've got a solid defense. You got a good offensive line. There's a lot of things to like there in wide receivers and even their tight end, David Njoku. I know he's hurt right now, but, like, guy's a playmaker. He came back last year after burning his face and wore like the invisible man mask or whatever and running around making plays on the field.
Yeah. How cool was it? Yeah, I did not see any kind of a mask or anything that Van Noy was wearing under his helmet, but we suspected that there might be some sort of disco bondage headgear like he had to wear like McCann wears for the Orioles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was hard to tell because I thought it at worst he was going to have to wear one of those visors that covers a lot of his mask. And if he was going to have to wear something, it was a little bit more gaudy because like with a broken orbital bone, orbital bone. I think you can still play through it. That's why you see a lot of NBA players wearing the hard mask and playing. It's just how much pain can you deal with that? You're not as much risk to re-injure it or make it worse that you think as long as you're covered, but strange things happen too. So I wouldn't have faulted him if he didn't play, but I'm glad he did.
Yeah, what a game. What a game he had. All right, what else do I want to talk about? I want to talk about a couple of scheme elements here. Hill out-snapped Henry 35 to 30. Kelly, zero snaps, by the way. The third running back is not always needed. When it's Kelly, he's not at all needed except for on kickoffs and punts and special teams as he was used. They didn't play any pony or empty in this game, so it was all one running back exactly on the field is the point I'm making in that. But this is the point I made earlier. Hill carried or received the football on 6 of 35 snaps where he's in, and Henry on 19 of 30 when he's in. So you made the point is, are you telegraphing where the ball's going? Which, hey, maybe you are because you have him in there on running downs mostly. Anyway, you have Hill on mostly on passing downs. Do you see that as an issue?
I mean, I think if you start to become, I think there's a lot of really good coaches that will figure out if you're doing similar things over and over again and try to take advantage of it. But you can also do that and then flip the script on them and change that up and all of a sudden catch a team at the wrong time if you feel like they're doing, if they're overplaying their hand and showing you. Because it's something we got to, and I thought you made a great point about Derrick Henry. Like, I don't care if you know that Derrick Henry's getting the ball in the backfield, but I do kind of care that you know I'm throwing the ball when Justice Hill's back there. I'd still like to see him get a few more carries. I wonder if anything changes once Keaton Mitchell's healthy, if we see more of a mixture, because he definitely adds something that the other guys don't have. But yeah, I mean, it is concerning when you're doing the same thing over and over again. But you almost feel like Derrick Henry's like Mariano Rivera's cutter. You know it's coming. Good luck tackling it. Good luck hitting it. Mm-hmm. But again, I don't like being the team that's kind of predictable, for lack of a better term.
They did have a really ineffective first half running the football. One of the things that the Ravens didn't do is they didn't lean on multiple things. They didn't lean on the read option play. They just handed the ball off, largely speaking. And I think part of the problem was that they didn't really want to let Lamar Jackson get continually hit by Max Crosby. And I think that might have been the impact of that, is he would have been crashing down. They would have been down blocking, letting him free. And it would have been a question of, they don't even care about trying to get to Henry. They just want to take Jackson out of the game. And they probably did not want that to occur this week.
That's such a great point, because I mean, I've talked to different people in the league that say, with the read option, yeah, there's so many great things with it, but some teams are going to be like, screw it. Go ahead and get a couple of yards. We're going to hit your quarterback on every single play that we get a chance, because we're allowed to, because we don't know if he has the ball or not.
Yeah. And that's key point there, is once you go to the mesh, then that quarterback's still an active target. And there's nothing you can do, like show your hands or anything that'll do that, which seems like you should be like a crap stealer or something and give the old, I don't have any extra chips in my hands here. The other thing that the Ravens really didn't do in this game is lean on personnel to get the point of attack advantages they typically will look to get. Now, the Ravens, obviously in 2019, in other years since, where they've leaned heavily on the read option, have been a point of attack offense that has been largely focused on Patrick Ricard leading the way. So yes, you run into an 8-man box, but you have an extra man at the point of attack who's extremely effective. And they only played Ricard 18 snaps in this game. So he's not 28% of the snaps. He's not really playing that much. I think he's at 27% for the season now. So it was significantly higher last year. I don't have the number on. It might have been 50 last year that he was on the field. They're just not playing a lot of heavies right now.
Do you think that changes in goal to go situations? Do you think they get heavier there?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm just wondering, because, like, look, Patrick Ricard, I still think he's a weapon and different things you can do with him. I've argued with some of my co-hosts about, yeah, he shouldn't touch the ball. No, I think, look, there's different ways to do things. But, again, like, I think game to game things will change. And the fact that you have options with what personnel you want to go to and you're comfortable, it's like, don't get complacent in one thing unless you're great at it. That's why, like, you get frustrated when the Ravens get away from the run game, because they're one of the best running teams in the history of the league. That being said, I was wondering, are we going to see more 12 and 22 personnel and how that would look this year? So I think it's interesting.
Yeah, it's very much, they have not made a commitment to 12 personnel in the passing game. And that was a big thing at the beginning of the year, is how do you get Andrews and Likely on the field together? Well, this last game, you can see they really didn't. Andrews played 63% of the snaps and Likely played 49% of the snaps, which means at the most, they were on the field together for 12% of the time.
That's baffling to me, because, like, look, you've looked at other teams, and I understand one of the things that was said to me is that they like their second tight end to be a very good blocker. And I think when you look at Likely, he's in space, he's a good blocker. I don't know in line if he's holding his own against some of these bigger guys. Like, I
completely agree, by the way.
Yeah, I love him out in space blocking, because he does such a phenomenal job. But look, man, I'm not to bring up this name, but Gronkowski and Aaron Hernandez were used properly. The Bills got to use Dalton Kincaid and Dawson Knox now, because they don't have a ton of pass options, or at least, really good pass options, until we see what these guys can do. But, it's something where Rob always talks, my co-host Rob Long always says, it's an either-or offense. And Why can't it be both? Why can't you have both tight ends out there making plays? Because, you know, I talked about getting the receivers out in space. You get Likely out in space, good luck. I mean, because he can throw guys to the ground and he can run by you, and he showed that in week one.
Yeah, it's, you know, obviously he had a great game against the Chiefs. The Ravens, you know, to give you a little bit of historical context, we're right around 2.30 heavies per play in 2022, which the last year of Roman, and was the heaviest in that, probably the heaviest relative in NFL history, but the heaviest in decades, in terms of actual tight ends, OL6s, and fullbacks on the field per play. Okay. Last year they dropped to right around 2, which is still heavy, but is much lighter with Monken. And then they're at 1.74 in week 1 against the Chiefs after an offseason of talking about how they're going to get both these guys on the field. After an offseason of losing receiving talent and being down, you know, they no longer have Beckham. So Beckham snaps should go to a tight end. It should be just, you know, pretty clear on that. And then the second week they go to 1.62 in terms of heavies per play, which is very light. And I'm having a harder time understanding it. They're still using a lot of eligible receivers to pass block. Want to get to that really, really quickly here in a second, but it just doesn't make sense to me that you'd go so light and then still, you know, want those guys to be a big part of your pass blocking effort.
Yeah, I don't get it either. I mean, look, it's something as the season progresses, maybe they'll kind of define themselves on offense and what they're going to be. But look, there's different strokes for different folks out there when you're watching the different types of sets that you can run and players you can go to, because for the first time in a long time, I love the skill position players on the Ravens, all of them. Like, I think they all add something, even if you want to go to Nelson Aguilar, which if he blocked in week one, maybe things are a little bit different. But that being said, I still think he adds something to this team, and he's a decent deep threat and a nice guy. I think he's a nice player to spell the other guys. And if you had to go to him for 2 to 3 weeks, I don't think it's the worst thing in the world either. But it's weird knowing that they have this type of talent, also that you have an amazing running game. And how do you mix this up? How do you make one help the other, or focus on one side and not lose the other one? And that's something we have to see with Todd Monken. I know year one, I liked a lot of the things I saw. I wish we saw more screen passes, quick things off the line to see how, you know, steal 6 or 7 yards here. One of my favorite things is watching Aaron Rodgers snap the ball and just throw it to Davante Adams or Alan Lazard. And it's like, he just got 8 yards on that. Like, where were the defenders? But, you know, you don't see a lot of that here, but I'd like to.
Yeah, certainly Lamar's not that on schedule thrower that really takes advantage of that, which is a little unfortunate. But last thing I want to mention here before we take a break here is there's 15 set and 15 chip blocks in this game. Set blocks, the eligible receiver stays in, makes a block, and never goes out for a pass. Chip block, he delivers his block, and then he goes out on a set of routes that is necessarily restricted because of the need to make a block. There's really a very limited set. You can't run a go route off a chip block. You run, you know, a flat or some sort of delay or outlet pass or whatever. You typically are really restricted in terms of what you can do. That is an enormous commitment on 34 plays, 0.88 blockers per play versus what was primarily a 4-man pass rush. So the Raiders, even with the fact that they only rushed 4, were very effective in getting the Ravens to use their eligible receivers as pass blocking assets.
It sounds kind of strange to me too, because like I like the I used to call it a pick and pop when I played football, where you'd have the guy go out, he chips the end if it's a tight end, and then he just kind of curls, and you have that little lane. You throw the quick pass. You've already had your receivers out on routes, and so now he gets a little bit of space to see what he can do in the middle of the field. It'd be a perfect play for, like, the Chiefs do it to Kelce all the time. And then they'll even go to Noah Gray. I don't even know if he's still playing. They'll go to their backup tight ends and do it as well when you start focusing in on Travis Kelce. But with the athleticism that the tight ends bring now, I don't know why we don't see more of those tight end screens. And I think it's a safer play, too. I think it's an unbelievably safe play to run. But, you know, it's one of those things where you're watching this team and seeing that the wide receivers are staying in the block more. I just feel like there's so much more they could be doing, unless we're just not reading. I know we're going to get to the offensive line and how poor things have been there.
Yeah, it's a lot to figure out still for this offense, unfortunately, even though they can look at this and say they weren't really the ones who lost the game. It was more about the penalties, et cetera, et cetera. There's still yards being left on the field, and Ravens have some learning to do from what was not a terrible skill position result in this game. Jeremy, it's always great to talk football with you, but I want to make sure you talk about what projects you're working on right now, aside from the radio maybe, and what you got going on and where people can talk football with you if they want to.
Yeah, so I have my own website, concretelocks.com. This is take two after I had a failed business experience with a business partner that stole my business, and now I'm running it by myself. I've got one of the kids that works at the radio station, Ben Hall, writes for me, and he does a great job. He's really sharp. So we charge $20 a month. I try to keep it cheap. I'm constantly throwing people free months and free plays and stuff like that. But it's something I have a passion for, and I've done this for a long time. You know, it's one of those weird things to say, yeah, I'm pretty good at gambling because, you know, I just had a buddy that retired from work and he's a full-time gambler now. As confident as I am in myself, I don't think I could ever do that. So it's pretty impressive. But I do love this. Like, before I came on with you, I spent 2 hours breaking down all the stuff that I was already working on this morning on the morning show. So it's my pride and joy. You'll see me posting about it. Other than that, that's kind of all I'm doing now with the website. I do jump on kind of time on the BetQL network and some of these other shows to do nationally. But I love talking sports gambling, so people can hit me up anytime. And my Twitter handle is @JayConSports. If you want to check anything out, it's all there.
All right. Just outstanding for you to be able to make time for this show, Jeremy. And I know you're not a passive. I don't have to ask you for it to happen. I mean, it's, you know, you're discussing, hey, you know, that's fantastic. Really appreciate it. And, you know, people like you who really enjoy Baltimore sports, but also have a particular bent, are exactly what keeps this show different on a week to week basis, like having you for gambling or having Melissa Kim tell stories of the club,
okay,
personal relationship with the players. Yes. she's a lot of ways. She's a very special person, but a walking fashion statement as well.
Yes. Yeah. She's great. So I actually had to reach out to her because I started doing like the Valley Girl. She would say, okay, all the time. And so she does kind of have that Valley Girl talk. And at one point, she said, all my friends are giving me grief because you keep making fun of me. So I sent her a message and said, hey, like, I love poking the bear and having some fun, but if anything I say offends you, just let me know. And she goes, are you kidding me? And I'm like, oh, well, sorry. Now I know who Melissa Kim is. Nothing offends her.
Yeah, she's terrific. Other folks out there, if you'd like to write a film study short, hit me up. DMs are always open on Twitter. There's less opportunity during the season because I'm doing 9 pods a week. But if you have something you want to talk about, I'm more than happy to do it. We'll try and fit it on a bye week. In particular, anything that you're passionate about, which is kind of a sliver of information. Let's talk about 15 to 20 minutes about something. You can't recreate the Ravens' entire passing game because that's going to be a 4-hour discussion. That's not what the short series is about. But I'd love to hear from you. And we also love when you use hashtag film study mailbag. We'll get into that in the second show. Jeremy, thanks again for coming on.
Anytime.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are now boarding Group A. Please have your boarding passes ready to scan. If your phone is cracked, old, or was chewed up by your Chihuahua travel companion, please refrain from holding up the line. And instead, simply go to Verizon and trade in any phone in any condition from one of their top brands for the new Samsung Galaxy S25 Plus with Galaxy AI on Unlimited Ultimate and a watch or tab, also on them.
Service plan required for watch or tab. Trade in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.